from WNPR. I'm John Dankosky, and this is The Wheelhouse.
There are indications now that the crisis in Southeast Texas is not over. In Crosby, Texas, the site of a chemical plant run by a company called Arkema Incorporated, massive fires broke out on Friday.
Here's where we stand right now with one of the strongest hurricanes on record into the Atlantic Ocean. Anguilla, St. Martin, St. Bart's, 100,000 people in the direct path.
North Korea saying it has tested its most powerful nuclear bomb yet. So President Trump now reacting to the news.
Mr. President, will you attack North Korea?
His answer, according to pool reporters, was, "We will see."
During the campaign, there was criticism of it. And then later, when the anti-immigration rhetoric was starting to heat up, this was the exception. He started to talk about, we're going to treat them with heart.
I'm here today to announce that the program known as DACA that was effectuated under the Obama administration is being rescinded.
So those are some of the stories we're going to tackle off of, out of this very, very busy week of news here in The Wheelhouse. You can join our conversation, 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter, at WNPR Wheelhouse. Joining us, as always, is Colin McEnroe. He's the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Howdy, Colin.
Good morning, Mr. Dankosky. Looking at the profusion of topics today, I feel like I'm at some especially disgusting version of hometown buffet.
We'll see what...
That wasn't meant to be a rhymed couplet, but it did come out that way.
What we pull off of the buffet line today with Harriet Jones, WNPR's business reporter. Hi there, Harriet.
Good morning, John.
And Dan Haar is here. He's columnist for the Hartford Current. Hello, Danny.
Good morning. It helps to be mean today.
Oh, there's so much going on today. So last week, we spent a good chunk of this program talking about Hurricane Harvey, the biggest rain event in U.S. history. It swamped Houston and Southeast Texas. Now the biggest recorded Atlantic hurricane on record is barreling down on the U.S. Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico and heading straight toward Florida, perhaps up the East Coast. We heard from Governor Malloy yesterday saying, it's time to get ready, folks. It is hurricane season in Connecticut, although we don't know exactly where Irma's going to go. Colin, we're just still dealing with this. I guess I'm wondering how exactly the federal government and state governments are going to deal with another gigantic hurricane heading right toward Florida while so many resources are deployed still in Southeast Texas.
Right. I think they might be wondering that, too. So this is probably going to be a different animal from Harvey. Hurricanes are typically three things, a storm surge, a wind, and rain. Harvey was mainly rain. It was just like the world's biggest rainstorm since the Bible. And this is probably going to be different. Obviously, the winds are up at 185 miles an hour as they cruise through the Caribbean. We don't really know, at least we didn't know half an hour ago, where this thing might hit the continental U.S. We do know that Puerto Rico will take probably a pretty huge hit. And I think in some ways that may test not only the resources of the United States, but I would say the conscience of the United States, too. I mean, Puerto Rico has always had this incredibly poor stepchild status. Its economy is in tatters already going into this disaster. I think it should be a matter of conscience to treat the people of Puerto Rico and the problems of Puerto Rico as moral equivalents to the problems of the people in Texas and Louisiana. So we'll see how that goes.
We'll see how that goes, and we're not exactly sure. One thing we do know, Harriet, is as the cleanup continues from Hurricane Harvey, there are an awful lot of resources deployed, not just from the federal government, from state governments, but also from the various insurance companies that reside right here in Hartford. People are sending just legions of folks down to try to assess the damage with drones, amongst other things. And that is a very long process indeed, only exacerbated by more storms hitting elsewhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. The insurers kind of gear up for this kind of thing. They see it coming. And they have these mobile units that they can send down. I think Travelers said they sent down three. Had them staged around where Harvey was going to hit so that they can move in, I think, from the north and west in that case, to be in place. And these are, units that they have satellite, they have their own power, they have generators. So even in a very devastated area, they can start assessing what the damage is. As you say, drones are now part of the equation. I mean, I think the FAA regulations on those came in very recently. So, insurers are really starting to ramp up their use of drones, which, of course, can be sent into more dangerous areas where people couldn't go and take pictures of damage. So that's, helping to kind of automate the process as well. But it's going to be interesting to see what the pattern of insurance claims is from Harvey, because, of course, flood is not covered in most people's homeowners insurance. So, something like Irma, which is expected to be a much bigger wind event, is probably scarier financially to the insurers than something like Harvey.
You know what's scary to insurers, Dan, and they've been preparing for years and years? Climate change. They actually really know that climate change is a big problem.
They believe.
They do believe in this. And so I guess I'm wondering how they're reacting to this series of massive storms battering the Gulf and the East Coast.
By raising rates. Eventually that's what we're going to see. This is not climate change obviously is not a short-term phenomenon. Last year we had a very mild hurricane season, and I would like to not have those of us who actually believe that – are we in the 99% or is it just the 90 who actually believe that human activity is affecting climate use individual storm events as ha-ha proof, because then it turns around when we do have, like we did last year, a mild year. But over time, as you said – travelers in the Hartford and the Allstates of the world do have science, and they show it with patterns that lead to higher rates. And also, I think zoning issues are going to come into fore. It may be a little bit less unpalatable to talk about zoning issues than climate change, or not unpalatable, but more sort of immediate. Because whether it's Connecticut or Houston or Miami, we're talking about areas that are built up, A, in the wrong way, and B, too much.
That also affects how we – it should affect how we approach the rebuild after Harvey, and presumably – I don't want to get ahead of ourselves, but whatever rebuild has to come after Irma. I mean, I think it's – in the case of Houston, I think it's a pretty easy thing to talk about. It's also a really complicated thing to talk about, but it doesn't – it may not make sense in certain cases to rebuild in areas that are simply incredibly flood-prone because of the pattern of development in a place like Houston. We can go back and look at Katrina. There was a lot of talk at the time of Katrina by engineers and geologists and people like that saying, no, make it smaller and taller. You know, don't rebuild in certain areas. That bumps up against people saying, oh, no, I have a house in, you know, the fifth ward or whatever. I don't know the wards very well there. I want my house back. Don't tell me I can't have my house back. And that sentiment seemed to prevail. There are fewer people living in New Orleans than there were before Katrina. But in terms of patterns of development and, as Danny says, zoning, things didn't, I don't think, change all that much. I'm wondering whether we'll learn that lesson now, particularly about Houston. It just doesn't make sense. He's shaking his head. We won't.
You're saying no.
Well, what happened with Houston is an example. And again, I want to be clear here that everybody in the country and the world is behind the victims of the Houston floods and need to help people rebuild their lives. This is not about, you know, aha, you know, you're in a situation where we're not going to help you. But looking at the big picture, this is a region, this is a city that spent 25 or really 50 years saying, you know, the hell with the rest of the country and the hell with science. Come here to Houston and build anything you want, anytime you want. You've got, as somebody said to me last night, you have a power plant next to a school, next to a brothel, next to a bookstore. There's no pattern. It's all paved over. And the whole point of economic growth there was there are no rules. And so now we're being asked to rebuild that? I don't think so.
You know, I think we're already demonstrating Colin's very first point, which was, what's going to get lost in the shuffle here is probably Puerto Rico, right? Because, you know, the voices in Texas and the voices potentially in Florida are going to be a lot louder. And what could happen to Puerto Rico is a real, you know, a humanitarian crisis, because they could lose a lot of their electricity. Their grid is very, very fragile. It could be gone for months. It could be gone for years. So what is the political will going to be, you know, for this part thing that's part of the United States to actually go in there and spend serious money and rebuild? I mean, you think about the debt crisis that's been going on for years and years and years in Puerto Rico, and it kind of falls in and out of the public consciousness. You know, we think about it once in a while. It's still ongoing, and they're going to have this potentially enormous weather event on top of that. You know, what is Congress going to do about that?
And we've also had this massive influx over the years of people fleeing the tough economic situations in Puerto Rico to places like South and the middle of Florida, which has changed somewhat the electorate there, amongst other things. And so we'll wait and see with that. I wish very good luck and health to all of our good friends in Puerto Rico who are facing down Irma this morning. There's another sort of storm that hit just yesterday as President Donald Trump ends the Dreamers program, the DACA program that it was an Obama-era program that allowed young undocumented immigrants to be shielded from deportation. Of course, almost everything that was part of the Obama administration was at the top of the list of things that Donald Trump was going to try to take apart. I think one of the differences here, Colin, is that this is a program that has certainly some bipartisan support, and it's awful hard whenever you have something like DACA that has faces attached, young people brought here not of their own volition, who have strived to make something of themselves in America. They're going to school, they've got jobs, and right now it looks like after about 6 months, a lot of them might have to find another place to live.
Right. I think one thing about DACA is, you know, there are an awful lot of policy issues where we can get into tussles and chase our tails around. And DACA has a kind of gut check quality to it, right? There's most people understand and can get pretty quickly to the idea that there's something fundamentally unfair about holding younger people responsible for decisions they didn't make. I just think, you know, in terms of how it pulls and, as you say, how it crosses political divides, I think that's the case. Now, I would love to know what was going on, as usual, what was going on inside the White House, what made them think that they needed to pull the trigger on this right now. It seems like they've gotten way ahead of even Republicans in Congress. We've just been drinking from the proverbial fire hose since the third week in January. Just stuff just keeps happening and happening and happening. So you've got this dropped into the midst of these two massive storms. It's just so difficult to digest it all. But this is such a troubling story to a lot of people that it's like holding its position in the news cycle against storms that overwhelmingly would have taken hold of the narrative and pretty much drowned everything out. So I think that's an indication of just exactly how much this kicks a kind of moral and emotional tripwire for Americans.
You know, like so many issues here, it's grounded in what the president can and can't do. And he's seen that he can't get tax reform. He hasn't seen it yet, but he can't get tax reform done in any meaningful way. He can't get health care reform done. He can't get his idiotic wall built because it actually costs money. And so this is something he can do. And what this is economically, it's in any other way, in respect to criminal justice, it's the opposite of a problem. These are people who are actually, by every study imaginable, these are people that are helping the economy and almost overwhelmingly not committing crimes. There are millions, maybe not millions, maybe hundreds of thousands of people who could be deported, where that's a more aggressive policy than I think the Democrats would like to see. But if you're going to deport people who have done something wrong, maybe do that first. I don't understand this.
Well, I'll leave out the qualifier that you used before. But in talking about building the wall, at least one of the things that we've heard coming out of Washington is that this is a type of way that Donald Trump gets at Congress to build the wall. If indeed these things are all tied together into some sort of massive immigration reform, then finally the wall is here because Congress doesn't want to get rid of these dreamers, and they probably don't want to build the wall either, but they got to do one or the other.
We would like to think that we live in a world where you can't get away with using 800,000 people as political pawns to get something else, when what is at stake is not inconvenience for them, but the complete destruction or disruption of their lives.
What world are you living in, Dan? Haven't you been reading the news this week?
I think, as Colin said, this is a litmus test, not just for us as to react, but for Republicans. And we've seen weak and non-response from Republicans, and they need to be held accountable.
You know, it's so eerily similar, I think, to the healthcare debate, right? In that this was a corner into which Republicans really didn't have to paint themselves. So they couldn't do anything. They couldn't figure out healthcare in the 7 years since, 7 or 8 years since the ACA was passed. And then they gave themselves this impossible deadline and they were writing things on the back of a napkin the night before a vote. This has the same feel. Okay, we're going to, you know, deport or do something to these 800,000 incredibly productive, you know, good citizens, unless you do something in 6 months. And Sarah Huckabee Sanders said yesterday, we're not just looking for a DREAM Act. We're looking for comprehensive immigration reform, which, you know, how long have we been, you know, at least 16 years we've been trying to do that. And the DREAM Act, you know, we've been trying to do since maybe 2007, I think. That hasn't been possible. How is it going to happen in the next 6 months alongside, you know, relief for two hurricanes, tax reform, maybe the revival of health care? Again, why are Republicans giving themselves this kind of impossible deadline?
Well, I think that there's Republicans and then there's President Trump. Of course, President Trump, through his Attorney General Jeff Sessions, makes this announcement yesterday, which was widely expected. But by the end of the day, Donald Trump, Colin, is tweeting, Congress now has 6 months to legalize DACA, something the Obama administration was unable to do. If they can't, I will revisit the issue. It seems as though he is putting Republicans in Congress squarely in the line here. They've got to do something about it. He's even hinting at what he'd said earlier, which is maybe I'll go back and, I don't know, maybe I'll do an executive order myself later.
Right, which would be bizarre because, I mean, the only sustainable argument for any kind of action on DACA of the kind that's been taken is would be that procedural or structural argument, whether or not President Obama really had the structural authority to do something like that. That's the only thing that you can muster as an argument for doing what is being done right now. So if he were to do something similar, that would be kind of weird. I just want to bring up – I'm actually maybe even going to get you to say a little something about this. But I mean what's odd here is you've got President Trump with his longstanding war against the Democrats and his even longer standing war against the Obama legacy. I remain convinced that we're sitting here talking about many things today because Seth Meyers and President Obama made fun of Trump at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and now we just have to reap this, you know, decades-long bitter legacy from that. So you sort of got that, and then you've got this incredible battle going between Trump and his own party. I mean, his battles with McConnell are now legendary, but really he's at complete odds with his own party. And it's worth mentioning that, to Danny's point about his stupid wall, a week ago he was threatening to shut down the government if he doesn't get his wall. And he was doing so unambiguously. At the Phoenix rally, it was very clear that he would do that. If you do that, obviously you pull the plug on FEMA and all kinds of disaster relief that has become even more important lately. So, but I think one point you were making as I came in this morning is that whole question of, I mean, in a way, now the DACA recipients and the whole country is increasingly in the same position as, say, President Moon of South Korea and lots of world leaders who, you know, I mean, there might be differences from president to president in American foreign policy, but not turnings of the dial from 10 to 0 or from 0 to 10. And that's what's happened on the foreign front, on the diplomatic front. And now you see this here domestically, right?
Well, but, yeah. And what is odd about it, I think, is you sort of watch American politics move forward. And we've always had bitter partisan divides. We've always had fights in Congress and in Washington. But I think, Harry, the thing that's kind of brand new is this notion that we might try to wipe away everything that the last leader did, whether it's healthcare, whether it's DACA. And I could imagine, honestly, in these new politics, that a Democrat who takes over the presidency and maybe has a completely Democratic Congress might feel like, well, it's time to roll back some of those Trump-era ideas about lower regulations. So we get to a point where whether you're a business trying to make some sort of decisions about what the tax code is going to be, or God forbid you're somebody who came here and signed up papers that said, I am a dreamer, I'm going to sign up for the DACA program, but now I'm worried that both me and my parents, who now everyone knows where they live, might get deported, that I can't trust that my government is going to be the same government now as it will be 6 months from now. And that's a little bit of a scary thing.
Oh, for sure. And, you know, I think you see some people in Congress reacting to this by saying, oh, hold on a second, maybe bipartisanship isn't such a, you know, a third rail after all. Maybe we can. And, it, you know, there are things that they're talking about in terms of, maybe we can do a DREAM Act, but pair it with a wall, you know, some kind of Frankenstein compromise. Or maybe we can do a debt ceiling and Harvey and, you know, stick those two things together. So there's something going on, to your point, in Congress with people saying, oh, you know, what is this that we've created where we're just bouncing from poll to poll?
Well, and if politics bounces from poll to poll, Dan, we all know where the real power in America lies. It's with the heads of these major corporations, right? Apple, Amazon, Netflix, AT&T, Facebook, Microsoft. They've all spoken out pretty strongly against the president's decision on DACA. Here's Microsoft President Brad Smith this morning on NPR.
If the government wants to deport a dreamer who is one of our employees, it's going to have to go through us to get that person. A tax reform bill needs to be set aside until the dreamers are taken care of. They have a deadline that expires in 6 months. Tax reform can wait.
So here's the head of one of the biggest corporations in America and in the world saying, you know, tax reform, that whole thing that a lot of American businesses care about, we don't care about that so much as not getting rid of these productive workers who are in our midst.
As usual, the tech sector is leading the way on progressive policy. Remember that the tech sector also is not in favor of the types of tax reform that for example, the middle America manufacturing sector is, because it's not asset-based. But I think the bigger picture here is that the corporations once again come to the fore on social policy, as they did with gay marriage, as they did with so many other things over the years, relatively quietly. And you're right that that's where the power lies. But I think we need to stop talking about this whole DACA phenomenon as a power play. This is the result of a mentally ill individual who won the White House because we pick the reasons why. I am sick and tired sick of being told that we need to listen to the victims of the economy who elected this nutcase in order to move forward. No, stop. This is a person who needs to be stopped. This is no longer part of a political process. The Republicans know that, and we need to hold their feet to the fire.
Preach, Danny. Preach.
I'm just one sidebar on Danny's point that the tech industry is the leader of progressive policies. Female software engineers might not agree with you.
And maybe not Uber, but
just,
other than
right,
that.
Just to that point. But, you know, it's not just tech, actually. I was at a convention of Connecticut farmers earlier this week, which is fascinating. They got together to come and talk to the agriculture secretary, and all of them, to a person, said, fix immigration, for goodness sakes, because even, you know, with nothing going on, they're saying people are no longer coming. They can no longer get people from Central America and Mexico because people are just feeling unwelcome here. And that's a huge impact on that industry.
If you think that we debate some pretty crazy things at the State House in Hartford, one of the things that they were debating at the State House in Montpelier in Vermont earlier this year, Colin, was what to do if the immigration policies of the Trump administration means that all of their workers who work in the dairy industry get deported. And they were actually talking about a bill that would deputize inmates of the various correctional facilities around Vermont to work the dairy farms. It didn't come to pass, but this is real.
That's
issues
for to, yeah.
for farmers in a part of the world where farming isn't all that easy. A last thought on this, Colin?
First of all, most farmers I've talked to are also not under any illusions about whether climate change is real. They live with that reality all the time. Yeah, I think what's one of the things that's really imploded here in the last 2 or 3 weeks really is that notion that we were electing a businessman as president, right? That was one of the narratives of the 2016 election cycle. He's a businessman. He's successful. He knows business. He knows how to make deals. He appears to have almost no capacity for making deals, first of all. He's really, really bad at it. But beyond that, I mean, the sentiment that Harriet and Danny are talking about, in many ways, started right after Charlottesville when people started departing the manufacturing councils and stuff like that and just denouncing this guy. And there's a lot – there are ways in which if you run a business these days, a big business, not just in the tech sector, you have to hew to certain standards. You have to hew to behavioral standards. You have to not do things that would get you into terrible employee-based lawsuits. There's just a lot of rules you have to follow. And there's no evidence that this man who Danny so beautifully described has much experience. I mean, I don't think that's how he rolled in the business sector. And so I think a lot of business people are looking at him and saying, he is not one of us. No, that's none of this is how we do things.
I'm going to take one phone call from Noel in Hartford. Hi, Noel. You're on the Wheelhouse. Oh, Noel's gone already. Well, you know, I'll tell you what. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about a few things. We're going to turn to some state issues, but we're also going to talk about Hillary Clinton's new book being leaked to the media and some fairly damning things to say about her her competitor in the race for the Democratic nomination last year. We're talking with Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR, Dan Harr from the Hartford Courant, Harry Jones from WNPR here in the Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. We're talking about the week's news with Hartford Current columnist Dan Harr, with business reporter from WNPR Harry Jones, and also with Colin McEnroe, the host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hey, Colin, what's on your show today?
So much to talk about. We got interested in the whole question of memorializing things post-Charlottesville. So we're doing a show about the way things are memorialized, the way monuments go up. And in particular, I got really interested in the difference between Civil War monuments and Maya Lin's incredibly epiphanic Vietnam memorial. So we're going to look at how a modern memorial is designed, too.
So memorials today on the Colin McEnroe Show. I will tell you that in case you're interested in global trivia, who isn't? I'm actually going to be doing something I do each year for the Connecticut World Affairs Council tonight at the Polish National Home in Hartford. It's a World Quest Trivia Night, and so we do all sorts of trivia from around the world, including a lot of stuff I don't know the answers to. But it turns out, because I've got the answers in front of me, I can act like Alex Trebek, and I seem very smart. It's from 6 o'clock until 8 o'clock, and it benefits the World Affairs Council of Connecticut.
You were described in the publicity as incomparable, which I think you should adopt as, like, maybe as a WWE kind of thing.
That's a great word.
The incomparable John Dankosky.
I mean, exactly. Who can argue, right?
Yeah, I know. No matter what you think of me, I am incomparable. Speaking of incomparable, let's listen to Wolf Blitzer, who got a hold of the new memoir that Hillary Clinton has written and a little bit of what she's written about Bernie Sanders.
Here's an excerpt from the book titled What Happened. He isn't a Democrat. That's not a smear. That's what he says. He didn't get into the race to make sure a Democrat won the White House. He got in to disrupt the Democratic Party. I am proud to be a Democrat, and I wish Bernie was too.
Okay, again, that's Wolf Blitzer reading from a leaked copy of Hillary Clinton's new memoir called What Happened. I don't know, Colin, I'll just ask you to react to that. A nice dramatic reading by Wolf, by the way.
Right. So there's two groups of people in the United States, people who think the only thing worse than Hillary Clinton getting elected president is what did happen, Donald Trump getting elected president. And the other group of people are the people who feel the opposite, that the only thing that would have been worse than Trump getting elected president would be Hillary Clinton getting elected president. So you put those two groups together, you got a lot of people. My reaction to that particular thing is this woman is shameless. If Bill Curry were here, he'd say more. But I mean, obviously, she's proud to be a Democrat. The institutional Democratic Party rigged the process for her. They got caught. I mean, there's no question about that. They got caught rigging that process. Anybody eyeballing the process could tell that it was being rigged in her behalf. So for her to be questioning the bona fides of Bernie Sanders or anybody else like that, I mean, look, I voted for her, but she's shameless.
I actually reasonably, politically at least, sort of fall in line with where she is on the spectrum. The issue is her ability to campaign. But I think this sort of reminds the Democratic Party, to the extent that there's legitimate criticism of what Hillary Clinton has to say after the fact. And by the way, no political memoir by a losing candidate can ever be seen as, oh, yeah, that person was right. Why they write these things, I don't know, because they always come out looking like sour grapes. But Matt Bai had a story last week about Pelosi and the leadership of the Democratic Party and how they are aging and no longer in touch. And I think this is a reminder, as much in Connecticut as any place when we look at the governor's race, that the Democratic Party needs to find new faces.
Well, we'll talk maybe about some of those new faces in just a moment. Well, let's turn to some state issues here, including big news coming out of United Technologies, Harriet. The aerospace units is set to get a lot bigger as the Farmington-based conglomerate announced it will buy Rockwell Collins in a $30 billion deal. Rockwell Collins is one of those businesses that I think most people don't know anything about until they're bought for $30 billion by United Technologies. What do they do exactly?
Who the heck are they?
Yeah.
So they're an Iowa-based company, and anything that United Technologies Aerospace Systems does not make for planes, pretty much Rockwell Collins does make it. So it's like bits and bobs. You know, it's lighting systems, it's brakes, it's wing flaps, that type of thing. So what this combination will create basically is kind of a nose-to-tail maker of parts for commercial jets, which the commercial jet makers are, you know, they're swallowing pretty hard. Boeing especially came out yesterday and said, you know what, if we don't like this deal, the way it goes down, we're going to encourage the regulators to look at it, which is not something you usually hear the customers of big companies saying. And really, the reaction across the board was pretty bad yesterday to this big tie-up. Investors sent the shares down more than 5%. The ratings agencies said, you know what, you've taken on so much debt to do this deal, we're going to look at maybe downgrading your bond rating. So, you know, nobody really had a positive reaction to this yesterday.
I'm wondering what this means to potentially, if this all comes together, for all the parts streams that currently are in place for United Technologies. I mean, I think one of the things you've covered for years is that, you know, anytime there's a big manufacturer, they rely on a whole bunch of little manufacturers who make one very specific widget that is needed for that plane. Is this signal a UTC trying to take more of that stuff under one roof?
Yeah, and drive out costs too, because what they said specifically said by the, I think the fourth year they want to drive down the costs by $500 million. You know, read that's $500 million is going to be taken out of that supply chain.
That's a lot of money.
Yes, it is, and you know it's the little mom and pop shops that will have to absorb that by getting more super efficient and doing things in different ways. So yes, I think it's going to create pressure all the way around in the industry.
With that great overview in mind, I want to ask the question of what it will mean for Connecticut. And one question is whether UTC will keep the building systems division, Otis, the security businesses, and Carrier. And as Harriet said, the debt is high. They actually have $9 billion in cash and the ability to borrow $10 billion more, which is what they need to make this purchase in cash, and still remain in the mainstream typical amount of debt. So it's not a big debt pill in the way that you would buy a million-dollar house if you had a $50,000 salary. But nonetheless, they did sell off Sikorsky to pay the debt on Goodrich, and that may or may not be good for Connecticut. It probably would be bad for Connecticut if UTC were to sell off one or more of those building systems divisions because there are a significant number of executives here in Farmington for them, but it's too soon to say.
I don't know. We're building in more urban areas. We're trying to build up, not out, Dan. We need elevators. I mean, we just talked about climate change. The world is warming all the time.
Yep.
Don't we need air conditioners? It seems like those are good businesses to be in.
Yeah, we do, and Honeywell would be happy to buy them and pay a lot of money for them, as we've already seen with Honeywell's offer 2 years ago to buy the whole company. And so there's no question that they're not going to go away. The question is what happens to them here. And also, I do want to make the point that UTC is typically known as a very disciplined company, meaning they don't overpay. This deal looks like a pretty big payment, a rich payment for what they're getting.
I don't know as much about business as these two journalists do, so nothing that I have to add would be particularly relevant. Although I will say, apropos of something that Danny just said, that one of my favorite and kind of overlooked stories of this week is that Otis is really involved in the Hajj this year. Did anybody else see this?
Yes, I saw that, yeah.
That Otis is, because they're really good at moving people around, and a lot of people show up in Saudi Arabia for the Hajj. They're using all their people-moving equipment. They've designed this special system, this kind of bespoke system, to get people to the sites they need to get to in a quick and orderly fashion, so... I was kind of impressed by that.
I actually did a story on Science Friday a couple of years ago about air conditioning at the Hajj. And this is what you need to do. You need to figure out how to cool and move around big groups of people.
One other note on the Rockwell Collins deal, though, as well as Boeing, somebody else who spoke out yesterday was Airbus, who said, hold on a second. If you're doing this enormous deal and trying to, actually integrate Rockwell Collins, which is a massive job, who's paying attention at Pratt & Whitney, which is having enormous problems trying to get their GTF pure power engines off the line and into the hands of customers with fewer technical glitches than they currently have? So Airbus was another maker that spoke up and said, maybe this isn't a good idea.
Let's start with the 32,000 people who work for Pratt & Whitney. That's just a little side show by Airbus, and I think they know it.
Let's talk about thousands of people who work for a company, Lego, about to make big workforce cuts. The Danish toymaker says it's going to cut 1,400 jobs, 8% of its global workforce. Turns out that Lego is based in North America, right here in Enfield, Connecticut. Any blowback from Lego making big layoffs here in the state?
We don't know yet. They haven't said how those cuts are going to fall. What I was struck by, actually, I have to say, in those numbers, I wasn't aware of the size of Lego's workforce. But if that's 8% of their workforce, they're pretty lean. To be honest, it seems like a low workforce for as big a company as it is.
They may have outsourced some manufacturing. In Enfield, they have 715 people. 8% of that, obviously, is about 50. So a big cut, but not as big as they've made in the past at various times. They've gone up and down over the years.
I want to turn away from some of the business news to something that, struck us, Colin, on the front page of the Hartford Courant. I'm just going to read a little bit from the story here. 9 state mental health workers were arrested Tuesday and charged with cruelty to persons in the first wave of enforcement actions in the largest patient abuse scandal in memory at the state's maximum security forensic hospital. This is Whiting Forensic Division. Colin, as you read through the details of this, it seems not only very, very gruesome, but also something that's been going on for quite some time.
Yeah, I don't think there's any way that could not be the case. So 31 suspensions, 9 arrests so far. Police saying more arrests are to come. This doesn't just start one spring afternoon. This is the kind of thing that has been going on for some time. I mean, it almost has to be to have that many people involved in it. And also, there's some profound – I mean, first of all, this is a stomach-turning story. This is Abu Ghraib on the Connecticut River. This is people torturing mental patients. I mean, that's what we're talking about right now. And this is the story that's almost getting lost in the shuffle of all the other stuff that we're talking about. It would be a much bigger story at a saner moment. there's huge questions about oversight here, and I think these questions probably have to be answered at the highest levels. I would guess that the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services is due for a massive house cleaning here. You can't have something going on at this scale and not know about it. It's sort of what people used to say about Reagan and Iran-Contra. If you didn't know about it, that's a problem. If you did know about it, that's a problem. Either way, you got a problem.
You know, so much of what we talk about, Harriet, on this program, when we talk about the size of government or the way to adjust Connecticut's government, is about how much we pay for things, the budget deficit, whether or not there are going to be deep cuts to social services or whatever else. Every once in a while, a story like this comes along and forces us to actually think about, okay, what is it we're supposed to be doing to help people and not to hurt, torture people? What is it that the state's role actually is here? And this may be one of those things that brings us into a little bit better focus for us.
Right, exactly. What services is the state supposed to provide? Who are we supposed to be caring for? And how much do we pay to do it? Because another element of this story was how much overtime these people were taking on for enormous sums of money. But, you know, how long hours were they working, and could they possibly be providing good care, you know, working those kind of long hours? The other point I wanted to make, if I've got the geography right, I think Whiting is at the Connecticut Valley Hospital, right?
Yes.
Which I think there are also DEMAS offices there. I believe the last time I interviewed the DEMAS commissioner was at that site. So it's not like this is some tucked away place in a corner of the state where, you know, the bigwigs never visited. This was pretty much
As this story unrolls, I think there's going to, first of all, to that point, there were people making more overtime than their base salary was, stuff like that. You have to be ignoring state auditor reports. You have to have people who are not involved in the scandal but further up the chain who are basically kicking back state auditor reports saying, we don't care, we're not going to do anything about that, and not reading those as danger signs. Also, some of this started as a complaint by Medicaid regulators. And I'm kind of wondering why federal Medicaid regulators would be the ones who finally said, well, this has got to be looked at for this particular reason. I don't understand that part of the story yet. But once again, it suggests a kind of blindness to the problem that was going on here.
The evidence so far shows abuse of one patient. Did I read that correctly?
Most of this is about the abuse.
And what's remarkable about that is that since there probably is no reason to believe this one 62-year-old patient was the subject of unique treatment, that would lead you to believe it was much more widespread than what we're seeing.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to actually turn to something Dan mentioned earlier about, who might actually want to take the job of governing Connecticut. We'll also mention this article in Governing Magazine that Colin talked about on his program earlier this week. And it looks like Eddie Perez is not going to serve any jail time, although he's now said he is guilty of some of the things that he was accused of while he was mayor of Hartford. We're going to talk about some of those things coming up next in The Wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. I'm John Dankosky, joined today by Harriet Jones, who covers business for WNPR, Dan Haar, who's a columnist for the Hartford Current, and our own Colin McEnroe. We're reading in the Connecticut Mirror today that Governor Malloy has made a big compromise to try to get a budget deal made. Reading here from CT Mirror, Malloy, who originally suggested communities cover one-third of the fastest-growing expense in the state budget, told the Mirror on Tuesday he would accept their contributing only the cost tied to present-day teachers. The massive and rapidly growing unfunded liability compensating for decades' worth of contributions not made by past governors and legislatures would remain the state's responsibility. So maybe with this compromise, we're edging closer to some sort of a deal at the state capitol. Meanwhile, on Colin's program earlier this week, Alan Greenblatt from Governing Magazine, who wrote a piece called How Did America's Richest State Become Such a Fiscal Mess, talked about some of these very things.
One of the things about Connecticut is for most people, things are great. Like I say, it's the richest per capita state. In most areas, the schools are good and all that kind of stuff. And when you have 169 cities and towns and things are good in 150 of them, it's going to be awfully hard to change. And so I guess I would just beat that drum saying, you know, you can't be successful if Hartford goes bankrupt.
All right, Colin. So you talked to him quite a bit. Did we learn anything new about why Connecticut has become such a fiscal mess?
No, I think it's always just interesting to have somebody more or less from the outside looking at a bunch of things that you've been looking at for a long time. I think most of the things in Alan's article are things that have been said on the show at various times. But it is interesting to look at them in aggregate. You know, to me, in a way, Hartford's problems are a good way of talking about Connecticut's problems. They're kind of similar, which is, as Alan even suggests in that excerpt there, you know, Hartford, I mean, one thing that Luke Broney keeps saying is if I could just get the patient out of the ICU financially, then there's a lot of things that we could do. There's a lot of ways that the city could grow in an exciting fashion. But it's really hard to do that when it's broken at this level. And now I think you can say the same thing about the state in ways that Greenblatt suggests. You know, the state has a tremendous amount of potential. There's a lot of things that the state already does well and can do even better. But it's hard to do that when you can't even pass a budget.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, some of the things that Molloy is trying to do and now is walking back a little bit. I mean, we talked a little bit about the teacher pension thing. It's hard to see how any of those are long-term fixes. And this is what a lot of legislators, especially on the Republican side, have been saying is, let's see some structural reform before we go forward with any kind of budget. And that teacher pension thing was a case in point in that. CCM's point the other day was he's not fixing anything. He's just saying, here, you pay for it. You pay for teacher pensions, and which shifts it onto property taxpayers, which is not in any way an actual holistic solution to the problem.
But before I go into Danny, I just have to say I was reading some of your body language when we were listening to Alan Greenblatt there, Harriet. You were waving your hands wildly in the air about what part?
Well, I think I disagreed with his point that most people are doing pretty great because, I mean, I think the data about Connecticut incomes is so hugely skewed by Fairfield County. I mean, you can't have people earning billions and billions and billions and, you know, not have a lot of poor people, you know, to balance that out. So I would disagree with his point that most people are doing well.
He does in the article make the point that we were about our incredibly slow recovery from 2008 and the fact that most of that recovery in terms of actual numbers of jobs, it has disproportionately skewed towards the low-wage sector,
right.
Jobs replacing higher-wage jobs.
I'm on Greenblatt's side of this debate. Hartford Metro, which includes no part of Fairfield County, is number, I think, 18 or 20 or so in per capita wealth in America. So it's not just Fairfield County, although that's the big part of it. And to that point, what we're seeing in respect to the fiscal meltdown amid relative wealth is a story about dispersion and distribution of income. We can't get at a fair share of the income because it doesn't exist in Connecticut in a form that we can tax. And so that's the reason that we have a state that's rich that can't pay its bills, because this $400 million is going to affect me as a relatively not rich person in a relatively wealthy town, West Hartford. And so if I have to pay the same amount of additional tax as my rich next door neighbor, then that means I won't pay it and there's political backlash. So it's really about distribution of income.
And I think also, I mean, Luke Brennan's other point that he makes frequently is, you know, the Hartford metro area really should be one unit, right? I mean, it wouldn't have the problems it has if it regarded itself as one unit, taxed itself as one unit, and distributed that wealth as one unit.
And the third issue quickly here has to do with how quickly you can exact change. It's fair and right for the towns to pay one-third of the teacher pensions. The question is, can you do that in one
you
year?
Can't exactly.
And the answer is
yeah.
No. It's like the firefighters' payouts. The Current had a story about the firefighters' payouts. It's going to be, millions of dollars. But that was part of an orderly change that Luke Broner negotiated, which naturally it's going to take time. You can't just say in one year you're going to solve the whole problem.
One point the Greenblatt makes in the article is, I mean, it's essentially what we say all the time about Connecticut, which is, you know, what's the most expensive way to deliver services? Well, divide a very small state up into 169 units and then have them all deliver those services on a private check handed to each citizen. He makes the point in his article that Houston has one sort of police and fire, consolidated police and fire dispatch center for the entirety of Houston, which, as we know, is a very big place. Connecticut has 111, and I think they're not, for the most part, conjoined police and fire dispatch centers.
I will say, though, that as much as we do talk about the potential for, say, county government here or larger governmental units than we currently have in Connecticut, one argument against that is that given our longstanding history of town-by-town rule, that probably county government would just mean, Harriet, what happens in an awful lot of places like western Pennsylvania where I grew up, which is you still have town government, right. But then you have a layer of
one
other government
layer,
on top
right.
of it. it, which means that honestly, you're still just paying all the same people, just maybe they have different jobs.
You're just adding managers, right? So, but it was interesting, I mean, not interesting for the people in Scotland, but the people in the town of Scotland last week, I think, said, you know what, we might have to what's it called if a town
becomes
disincorporate? We actually have to disincorporate because this is going to break us financially. I've seen it. I live in Stonington. The people in North Stonington just voted. Actually, had a they were going to try and combine our two high schools because of falling enrollment. And people in North Stonington said, no. We want to keep our high school. We want to keep our expensive superintendent. So there's this I wonder if this system of 169 towns, under this kind of fiscal pressure, how is it going to react? Are things going to, by force be reorganized?
Just as Harriet said that, I was looking at the map of Scotland and seeing what it was next to. And if Scotland made that, quote, threat.
Next to Rhode Island. Yeah. So next
well,
to
that's right. If Scotland made that threat as a sort of like a doomsday scenario like Hartford, then forget about it because it looks like we've got Hampton, Baltic, and Scotland in a triangle, and we can have Ham-Ball-Scott as one town. And I think what Colin is saying is that Connecticut is to governance what Houston was for zoning. And it doesn't work.
Well, let's just speak quickly about governance. Two stories out of this past week, Colin, that we want to get to. We've mentioned Luke Bronin a number of times. Eddie Perez, who held this job previously, he has now pleaded guilty to taking a bribe and attempted first-degree larceny by extortion, but he was spared prison time. We've been hearing about this Eddie Perez saga for quite some time now. It looks as though now he's going to move on and be able to live his life, I don't know, maybe get back into politics. I mean, what should we read from Eddie Perez not serving any jail time for his time leading Hartford?
Well, I mean, I think around the time I joined this station, which was 8 years ago, I said to Jeff Cohen, Hubie Santos is the master at dragging out a criminal case until people have died or they've forgotten what their testimony was going to be or whatever. And this here, proves the point of that. He was Eddie's defense counsel. I think the more important thing here, and we can get back to Greenblatt in a way, he's very critical of the fact that Connecticut hasn't positioned its cities to take the influx, to welcome the influx of millennials who want to live in cities. To whatever extent that trend continues anyway, we're not ready. One point I made to him is, in many ways, Luke Bronin is the first fully functional, technocratically able mayor of Hartford. And if you go back two mayors, you get this guy, who's lucky that he's not going to prison. Bridgeport is being run by an ex-convict. So one of the reasons – it's not just bad statewide policy that favored the suburbs over the cities, although it is that. But the cities have had trouble finding adequate leadership.
Okay, speaking of finding adequate leadership, what should we make of the news, Danny, this week that Kevin Lembo, the state comptroller, who was seen as one of the leading candidates running for governor on the Democratic side, said, you know what? This job isn't for me.
I like Nancy Wyman. I think she's a wonderful lieutenant governor, was a great comptroller, and is a good public servant. If this is a signal that she's going to be the standard bearer for Connecticut, the Democrats need to think really, really long and hard about whether that means it will hand the governorship to a Republican.
And Kevin Lembo, of course, somebody who's been, pretty willing to speak truth to power, talk about some of the fiscal problems that are out there that are plaguing the Malloy administration, even when the administration doesn't necessarily want to say it.
Yeah. So what he said to me in making his announcement was that all of the issues that he's passionate about, which is transparency, retirement security, healthcare, those are all kind of seated at the job he has now, and he doesn't want that broader governor's portfolio, which is an interesting thing to discover. Considering, he must have known what the governor's job was when he got into the race, but whatever.
I think Danny's clearing his throat, saying something over there. Colin, a last thought on this?
Kevin Lembo has got young kids. I think one of the reasons he did this, made the decision he made was, a governor's race is an all-encompassing thing, and you really have to incredibly want to do this to do it. But I think Dan's point is an important one. We're either going to have a thinker, somebody who really thinks about problems and tries to solve them, as our next governor, or we're going to have a demagogue like the guy that we got elected president. And right now, I don't see a real – Lembo was probably the closest thing to a thinker that I saw anyway in the field. Maybe I don't know the other candidates well enough. But they need to get some fresh minds and exciting new ideas out there.
Before we run out of time, we've got about a minute and a half to talk about two baseball stories. Danny, you wound up your trip down Route 44 earlier this year. You spent some time in Hartford, the North End, as they were building this brand new baseball stadium. Now at the end of the season, what do people in the North End actually think about Yard Goats baseball?
toward the end of the season, it started to catch on a little bit more than earlier. And earlier in the season, there were relatively few North End residents that I saw in the ballpark when I went. Later in the year, a great pickup. I think it points to tremendous potential going forward, but it's something that can't just happen automatically. There has to be strong outreach because the black presence at baseball games around the country is not what it should be or could be.
Of course, the presence of technological devices at baseball games. Colin, of course, the big news of this week.
Yeah, so Red Sox are using Apple Watches to steal signs. The Red Sox fan in me says, well, you know, I mean, Bobby Thompson's most famous home run ever was probably hit off stolen signs that Leo Durocher had obtained. On the other hand, yeah, I don't know. Boston's getting this really bad reputation for high-tech cheating, which is maybe not a reputation that you want to get.
Not something great for the Boston sports fan in many of us.
And I wasn't just talking about GE. Just kidding, GE. Although they are downsizing there
already. Yeah.
Colin McEnroe, the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Thanks, Colin.
Thank you.
Thanks to Danny Haar, who covers commerce, economics, wealth, and poverty for the Hartford Current. Thanks, Danny.
Vote Colin.
And thanks also to business reporter WNPR, Harriet Jones. Thank you, Harriet.
You're welcome.
Our program is produced by Kion Wolf, our technical producer, and Katie Solarski, the executive producer. Thanks to our digital editor, Heather Brandon. Safe travels, Heather.